Probably the most influential philosophic position today, which is not well known in the Western world, is the philosophic position of Friedrich Nietzsche. Particularly during the 60s, a great deal of radical college behavior was explainable in terms of Nietzschean philosophic approach to life. And particularly in European universities, Friedrich Nietzsche has been extremely influential. In the United States, he's virtually unknown as a thinker, which is not unusual for the United States. But he's a man who deserves much more attention, both from a positive and from a negative standpoint, than he has gotten. I've entitled this lecture The Apollonian and the Dionysian because Nietzsche explains and accounts for human behavior, human culture, in terms of these two notions, which since his time have gotten increasingly influential and increasingly important, particularly in psychology. Friedrich Nietzsche was born on the 15th of October in 1844. Those of you that are Kierkegaard fans know that Kierkegaard wrote his works between the mid-40s and the mid-50s of 1800. So you see, Nietzsche was born right at the beginning of Kierkegaard's most fruitful period. Nietzsche died on the 25th of August in the year 1900. He was born in the small town of Recken-Lützen. And any good Swede ought to know where Lützen is and what's important about Lützen, because it was at the Battle of Lützen in the 30 Years' War that the good Lutheran king Gustavus Adolphus was killed. So it was at the little town of Recken-Lützen in Saxony, right in the heart of Lutherland, that Friedrich Nietzsche was born, the son of a Lutheran minister. Both of his grandfathers had been Lutheran ministers, and that had been true for four generations back. The family was strongly pro-government, very patriotic, and so he was named Friedrich Wilhelm, after the current king of Prussia. When he was 5 years old, his father suddenly became insane and died shortly thereafter. So at the age of five, Friedrich Nietzsche had lost his father, and he was raised for the rest of his juvenile life by his mother, his grandmother, two maiden aunts, and an older sister, which explains a lot. The household was poor but proud. They had a long heritage of Lutheran clergy background, and while they didn't have a great deal of money, widows' pensions didn't amount to much in those days, they had a great deal of pride, and all those ladies in the home were very strongly pietistic and very strongly legalistic. And Friedrich got all of his ideas about what Christianity is all about from that kind of home background. When he was 6 years old, he attended a school called the Forteschule, the School of the Door. It was called the School of the Door because there was a famous ancient medieval nunnery that had been located in the town, and all that was remaining of it was the doorway from the old nunnery, and so it was called the School of the Door, the School of the Doorway, and it was one of the distinguished elementary schools of Germany. When he became college age, he went to the University of Bonn. Nobody seems to be able to explain why he went to the University of Bonn, because he lived way over in the eastern end of Germany, in Saxony, and the University of Bonn was on the Rhine River, way at the opposite end of the country. He was living in Leipzig at this time, and the University of Leipzig was one of the old, very distinguished universities of Europe, and why he didn't go to the University of Leipzig instead of the University of Bonn, we really don't know. But he went to the University of Bonn, and he went there for a semester, and the second semester he transferred to the University of Leipzig, from which he ultimately graduated. When he was in the gymnasium preparing for the university, Nietzsche very much thought he would like to be a musician. He was quite talented in music. He loved music, particularly the music of Mozart, and he thought he would like to be a professional musician. His mother wanted him to be a pastor, like Daddy was. So when he went to the University of Bonn, he enrolled in the Divinity School. The University of Bonn Divinity School was outstanding for its lack of theology in those days. It was very hard to find a practicing Christian, and well nigh impossible to find a believing one, which was sort of typical of divinity schools in those days. He had, one of the things which he did at the University of Bonn was publicly renounce Christianity. Second semester he was at the University of Leipzig, and he ultimately specialized in classical philology, which is not one of your most popular subjects even today. Classical philology. He continued through the upper degrees, and in 1869 he was offered a professorship of philology at the University of Basel. Now, to us Americans, that doesn't sound, you know, particularly strange. So what? He was 25 years old. It's rather young to be a professor, not an instructor or a graduate assistant, a professor. Number two, he did not have the earned doctorate yet. He wouldn't get it for another year. But his work had been so outstanding that the University of Basel asked the University of Leipzig if they would release him from his commitments and permit him to complete his doctoral studies, but be a professor at Basel. Now, in the European university system, when you're working for an advanced degree, you aren't just working for an advanced degree. You have certain commitments to the university, so that particularly if you're working on your doctoral program, you teach at that university. That's part of the game. You belong to the university, and even after you have your doctorate, you're expected to remain there for a certain number of years and teach. You know, hopefully you get a professorship thereafter. Basel wanted to take him from Leipzig as a professor at Basel without the doctorate at age 25. And the University of Leipzig consented. Following the year, he completed his doctorate in classical philology. This was how outstanding he was, and how highly they thought of him. Well, while he was at the University of Basel, he became friends with and helped to popularize a man who was as old as his father, but a man who had had a rather stormy and turbulent career. And Nietzsche is one of those who made this man fashionable and popular. The man's name was Richard Wagner. He was living near Lucerne in Switzerland at the time. I think he was with Franz Liszt's daughter at the time. He varied the ladies he lived with at various times. I think he was with Franz Liszt's daughter at the time, eventually married her. He became a friend of Nietzsche. Vice versa. Nietzsche wrote a number of essays praising Wagner, and for a while he thought Wagner was the greatest thing that had ever happened to music. One of the things that he particularly liked about Wagner was that Wagner was also against Christianity. He was practicing anti-Christian. Now, this is the period of time during which Wagner wrote the Ring Cycle. All of these operas which resurrect and glorify ancient German Teutonic paganism. And it was done deliberately by Wagner as an attack on Christianity and an argument that the German people should be practicing German religion, not Jewish imports from the Near East Christianity. Well, in 1870, the Franco-Prussian War broke out, and while Nietzsche had taken Swiss citizenship in order to teach at the University of Basel, his feelings of loyalty to Germany were very strong. He attempted to enlist in the German army. He was turned down for medical reasons. He finally succeeded in becoming a medical orderly, and he saw service on the front. It was during this period of time, apparently while he was working as a medical orderly, that he contracted syphilis. Now, this is a speculation, because there's some reason to believe that Nietzsche died of terminal syphilis, and we know from the character of his personal life that he very likely didn't contract it in the traditional way. And so the only way we can figure that he might have contracted it was through, you know, working with wounded soldiers in the War of 1870. All right, well, at any rate, from 1869 to 1878, he taught at the University of Basel, and we call this his aesthetic period for reasons which will shortly become clear. Now, one of the interesting things about Nietzsche is that during his almost 30-year career as a philosophic thinker, he propounded three distinct philosophic positions, each one of which is compatible with the other two. This is highly unusual. In our lifetime, a man named Ludwig Wittgenstein developed two philosophic positions that were incompatible with one another. But Nietzsche developed three. He developed the first one, which was an aesthetic kind of position. He discarded that one, developed a second one, discarded that one, developed a third one, and at his death was about at the point of discarding that one also. At any rate, this is called the aesthetic period, and it is from this period that we get the notions of the Apollonian and the Dionysian. These two terms are taken from Greek mythology. The first one, Apollo-like, the second one, Dionysius-like. Apollo, among other things, was the god of reason, god of rationality. Dionysius was the earthy, basic life force god. His festivals were in the spring, when the seemed to coincide with the time when the previous year's wine just was ready to be drunk. And a great deal of sexual activity was associated with Dionysius. One of the men who was strongly influenced later on by Nietzsche was Sigmund Freud. As a matter of fact, Sigmund Freud said that he got all of his ideas from Nietzsche. And Nietzsche's notion of the Dionysian pretty much corresponds to Freud's notion of libido, the basic elemental life force which animates the human being, except that Nietzsche saw this in broader terms, and he saw it as the basic force in anything living. That's the Dionysian. It is a blind impulse. It's about its only principle is self-preservation. Other than that, it's just simply a burgeoning life force, which tends to express itself in bursts of energy which are usually considerably too great for the situation. As for instance, when a couple of fish in the ocean breed and they produce 10,000 eggs, you know, and they go flying all over the place. You know, this fulsomeness of life force. That's the Dionysian. It is the creative, the productive force in the universe. The Apollonian is the rational, disciplined, creative, organized force in the universe. And Nietzsche argued in his aesthetic period that culture, as we know it, is the product of the imposition of the Apollonian upon the Dionysian. The Apollonian without the Dionysian is lacking in force. The Dionysian without the Apollonian is lacking in direction. But you put the two together and you get creative possibility. The universe is a Dionysian universe. It is a blind, meaningless, purposeless thing. It's simply violent forces interacting with one another and battling with one another for survival. For what purpose? Nobody knows. And so the Dionysian is meaningless. If man were to view reality the way it really is, he would do either of two things. He would either immediately commit suicide or he would go insane, incurably insane. Man cannot face the awfulness of reality. And so he makes use of his rational powers to create protections from reality so that he can survive. And he argued that it was the Greeks who first creatively solved the problem of existence and made life, made the possibility of meaningful existence. He used as his paradigm the Parthenon. And he argued that the Parthenon was the Apollonian principle at work. Now imagine that big white rock in the center of Athens, you know, with the summer sun blasting off of that great white rock. You know, impossible to live there. Intolerable conditions for survival. Man goes up there for half an hour, he goes mad from the heat. But we erect a roof over his head with rational columns, a rational structure, and he's able to survive. And as we look at the roof, all around the roof, what do we see? We see the panoply of the gods. And so the Greeks invented mythology. And it's by means of our myths, by means of our mythologies, that we are able to survive in a meaningless, hostile world. Sounds kind of like some recent theologians, doesn't it? And that's where they got their ideas about mythology, from the early Nietzsche. Nietzsche wrote a book called The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. If you remember what you know about Greek culture, you know that the ancient Greeks in the spring of the year would have Dionysian festivals, which were music festivals. They were choral songs that were done in honor of the god Dionysus in order to make them larger and more spectacular. They built outdoor amphitheaters where these choral services could be held, and they sacrificed to the god Dionysus on the altar, which was in the center of the circular area with the risers at the back where the choir stood. And that was the forebear of the Greek stage, beginning with the music festival. Well, in The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music, Nietzsche argues that there is a very definite progression of the Apollonianizing of Dionysian structures that culminates finally in the highest structure of which man is capable, the Greek tragic vision of life and Greek tragedy as its physical expression. We begin with the event. An event happened sometime in prehistory. This is a Dionysian occurrence. It's the interaction of human beings with one another. What tends to happen to it? It gets Apollonianized in what? A folk tale. We reduce it to a verbal structure. We develop a story about how Hercules cleaned the Augean stables, you know, or how Jason secured the golden fleece. So we come up with a story. We structure it so that we can preserve it. And maybe we do it in poetry so that it can be preserved better. Because prose doesn't keep as well as poetry does. Poetry has better memory qualities than prose, and it also has better keeping qualities. So it gets structured. We put an Apollonian shape onto it. What happens after this? A lot of these stories get brought together and they get built around a single character. a character like Odysseus or Jason or Aeneas or Achilles, and we create the epic, which is a burgeoning out into a full-blown character from the little folk tale. What happens to this? We structure it out, and we perform it under structured conditions. We invent, he says, Doric art. We invent a situation in which formally it can be done. Maybe we develop a rhapsody, as the Greeks had, and the rhapsode was the person who got up and declaimed epic poetry with the accompaniment of a musical instrument. So we structure it in formal kinds of structures. Then we create the musical event. We add music to it, and finally then we give it thought. We give it philosophic significance, and we have the Greek tragedy. Now it's very interesting as you watch each one of these six items that you find that they correspond to what Aristotle in his Poetics had called the six qualitative parts of poetry, namely plot, diction, character, melody, spectacle, and thought. And so when thought finally is added, the last Apollonian thing is added to it, it becomes a meaningful body of ideas. And so every Greek tragedy presents us with a coherent view of reality. And the view of reality which we get is that reality itself ultimately makes no sense. There's something wrong with it. It doesn't operate according to the principle of justice. Good men suffer, bad men succeed. And bad men get away with it, and good men suffer, who knows why. And ultimately, it doesn't balance out. And we find oftentimes great men destroyed at the heights of their power, which is what a tragedy is all about. Ultimately, we have a universe which is irrational, but we can make it tolerable by means of rationality. The last 10 sections of The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music are a rhapsody on how terrific Richard Wagner was. Well, in 1878, Richard Wagner completed his latest opera, and he sent a copy of the opera to Nietzsche, down at Basel. Crossing it in the mails, going the other way, was an essay in praise of Wagner, which Nietzsche had just published. Strangely enough, this was the end of their friendship, and it was the end for the rest of both of their lives. They hated one another from this moment on, because Wagner had written an opera about a pure and holy medieval knight who was given the sacred task of searching Europe for the cup which our Lord had used at the Last Supper, and which had been preserved by the church for a time and then lost, the Holy Grail. And this Teutonic knight ultimately finds it, and on Christmas night he comes to Cologne Cathedral, and he marches down the long main aisle, and he marches up to the high altar, and he places the Holy Grail upon the altar. What had Wagner done? He had written an opera called Parsifal, and it was in praise of the sacrament of the altar, the heartbeat of the Roman Catholic Church. Wagner had capitulated to Christianity, and Nietzsche wrote him off. And from that time on, any time he ever said anything about Wagner, it was very, very negative. Wagner had given in to Christianity. He had not kept the unfaith. Well, this was more than Nietzsche could take, and he had a nervous breakdown at this point. He resigned his position at the University of Basel. He rested for a time at his mother's home at Weimar. And then he decided he had best go back to the university and find out what had been happening. Now, his total university training had been in the classics. And there was one area where he had had virtually no training, and that was in the sciences. So he went to the University of Berlin, and he studied for a year or so. And what do you suppose he encountered? The latest in thing was evolution. What does evolution say about the Apollonian and the Dionysian? Now, in his first stage, his aesthetic stage, he had said, the Apollonian makes sense out of a meaningless Dionysian universe. What does the theory of evolution say? It says there is a rational order and purpose to the Dionysian. Nature moves in an evolutionary kind of way, in an orderly kind of structured way. The Dionysian makes sense. What about the Apollonian? What about human rationality? It's unnatural. It's artificial. It's wrong. Whatever is natural is good, and so we must go to nature to find out what life is all about and what our role in life is. Now, he, like most Germans of his time, was a positive evolutionist. In other words, he believed that life is getting better and better, that nature, that each stage of development of nature is better than the previous one, and, you know, this kind of a glorious future that lies ahead for the whole universe. Well, when he took a look at the way things were going on in the world, he came to the conclusion that the ethics of the world were all screwed up. Why? The basic principle of nature is struggle. Struggle for survival, right? The war of all against all, as Thomas Hobbes had said, talking about natural man. The natural is the good, therefore we ought to have the war of all against all. War is a good. Peace is an evil. Hate is healthy. Love is pernicious and weakening. Now, for some reason or other, mankind, particularly mankind in Western Europe, you know, the cannibals and the Aborigines were still doing all right. But civilized man, with his Apollonian universe and his Apollonian culture, for some reason or other had developed the very absurd and mistaken notion that he was the crown of the universe and that the world existed for his purposes and that he represented the ultimate and the culminating point of development of nature. As a result of this and some other foolish notions, he had come to the conclusion that war was bad and peace was good. He was acting in all kinds of unnatural ways, like, for instance, when people got sick, he didn't let them die. But he invented horrible, immoral places called hospitals that made weak people strong, contrary to nature. And developed life, if he were living today, you can imagine what he'd be saying about our life support systems and things of that sort. Will you keep helpless, vegetable-like people alive day after day after day? How insane can you be? You have kids whose parents die. Well, tough luck. So they invent these ungodly places called orphanages where they're taken care of. You invent places like Holden Village, where people that are having problems are helped by other people. You know, how evil a place can you develop? Why don't you let, you know, the people that can't handle it go down, get destroyed? You know, you don't find a deer orphanage in the forest here, or a bear orphanage, you know, or a deer hospital or anything like that. Everybody's on his own. And this is the way nature intended it. Because of the evil way that the world has developed under the influence of one particular pernicious organization, evil organization, even hate to mention the name of it, called the Christian Church. You know, man has been weakened and emasculated, with the result that nature is being held up in her evolutionary development. Now, we know from a study of nature that there was a certain point when everything that existed was the inorganic. But the inorganic didn't hold things up and said, "There will be organic over my dead body." But it was willing to sacrifice itself that the organic plant world might exist. And the organic plant world did not fight against the development of the animal world, you know, but was perfectly willing to get eaten so that animals could be. And animals suffered the development of man, you know, so that man could have beef steaks and pork chops and things like that. But what does man do? "There's not going to be anything higher than me." So he's holding up evolutionary progress. He is holding up the development of the superman, of the overman, of that which comes next. And for Nietzsche, the overman or the superman notion is whatever comes after man, that which is superior to man. And so man very easily is holding up nature. And so consequently, what man has to do is to return to harmony with nature. Kind of a perverted romanticism. We have to return to a harmony with nature. The war of all against all. Fight wars and battles so that only the most powerful people survive. Take risks. Live dangerously. And he wrote a book which is magnificent poetry to express his doctrine. It's called Also Sprach Zarathustra, which is probably his greatest work, Thus Spake Zarathustra, where he sets forth his doctrine in poetry of the coming of the superman. One of the things which has held up the emergence of the superman is the mythology of Christianity. Where in his first stage he talked about mythology as a savior of mankind, now in his second stage it's the mythology, it's religion that has weakened mankind and has held up progress. And so he has a very famous section which is usually not found in most American translations of Thus Spake Zarathustra. It's the famous "God is Dead" section, where Zarathustra, the young prophet of tomorrow, who is announcing the coming of the superman and the need for people to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the superman, he bumps into an old rattle-tailed priest. And after a short conversation, he discovers that this is the last pope that there ever was on the face of the earth. And he says, "Tell me, you were present. How did God die?" You know, and the Pope tells him, "Yeah, I was present. I was the one that placed the coins on his eyes when his eyes shut for the last time." The trouble with God was he had too much sympathy. He wasn't hard and tough. He was a softy. And so he just couldn't survive. Kind of reminds you a little bit of the Grand Inquisitor chapter in Brothers Karamazov. So God can't survive. And he's not the right God for the world as we know it. So he died. And of course, the whole "God is Dead" theology of all types and friends came out of the section of Nietzsche. So what we have to do is to rewrite our morals and get our morals straightened out, get in accordance with nature, so that the superman can emerge. Now, it's about 50 years after this that we get two men come along who take Nietzsche quite seriously and attempt to bring it to pass in Central Europe. And this is Mussolini and even more explicitly Adolf Hitler, who then attempted to change the European arena to an arena of constant fighting, constant battle, and a testing of the races to see which race would survive as the super race. Well, in 1889, he had a mental breakdown. Now, during the period from 1879 to 1889, which we call his positivistic period, he suffered a great deal from migraine headaches. He also had a great many allergies, and his eyesight was beginning to fail. He would have migraine headaches. I don't know how many of you have had migraine headaches. I have, and my bride has upon occasion. But he would have a migraine headache that would last for 3 weeks. And the migraine headache would be so terrible that he couldn't wear any clothes. And he couldn't stand light. And so he'd be in a darkened room lying on silk sheets. He couldn't even have sheets over him. And he still would be in intense pain until finally it would just go. He had all sorts of allergies. He couldn't stand much temperature change. And so most of the time he tried to live in the summertime in certain parts of Switzerland and in the winter in northern Italy. And he drank northern Italian wines, which were the only ones that he could tolerate, and I've not been able to understand that because northern Italian wines are pretty lousy. But they were the only ones that he could tolerate without getting sick, and he ate peasant's bread and simple cheese, and that's all that he could eat. But he was writing furiously during this time. And finally, he had a mental breakdown. He argued that he had been arguing that only the Dionysian is meaningful, the Apollonian is artificial, and we must operate on a survival of the fittest basis. Even though Also Sprachser Tustra was published at this time and was his greatest work, he was almost totally ignored as a philosopher until 1888. Professor Georg Brandes at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark began lecturing, and within 10 years, shortly before Nietzsche's death, he was an internationally famous figure, except in the United States. From 1889 until his death in 1900, he was off and on insane, and many of his writings are rather incoherent. But he did develop a third philosophic position, and we call this his voluntaristic period. As a young student at the university, he had run across the writings of Arthur Schopenhauer, the great German pessimistic philosopher, who had argued that what we think of as reality is really ideas in our mind. And the only realities that there are in the world are human wills and ideas. There is no meaning to existence. There is no value to existence. And the only thing that has any kind of value is the human will. And there is only one moral act that a honest, ethical human being can perform, and that is to commit suicide. We can't help it that we were born, but we can sure get rid of it. And that's the only honest, ethical thing a person can do, is commit suicide. Because life isn't worth living. It's a lie. Well, not exactly your philosophy lived by, is it? Well, in his last period now, Nietzsche returns to a kind of variety of Schopenhauerian pessimism, but only there's a certain element of optimism about it. In the first period, you recall, the Dionysian was meaningless. In the second period, the Apollonian was meaningless. In the third period, they're both meaningless. And the only thing that has any value is the will, particularly the will to power. And so, among other things, Nietzsche is the father of all subsequent self-development psychologies. And it's in this third voluntaristic or will-oriented period that he argues The basic drive in man is his will. Not the Dionysian impulse, but the will. It is the drive to overcome one's own limitations and to become a creative person, to get control over one's environment and surroundings, to make something of oneself that one can be proud of. So you create your meanings and your values out of your own guts and out of your own environment. Neither art nor nature have any meaning or purpose. That alone which has value is a product of the human will. But to succeed as a human being and to become a real person requires self-discipline and a great deal of hard labor. One of the most significant books by Nietzsche in this last period, and none of the books of the last period were published until after his death, but one of the most significant ones, and I suspect it will become increasingly significant, is particularly as people in the United States rather baldly and openly and sort of cold-bloodedly are talking about euthanasia, is a book which he called Twilight of the Idols, which was a book of ethics for physicians. And among other things in it, he recommends euthanasia. And he also recommends suicide under certain conditions. And he argued, we cannot determine how or when we are born, but we can certainly determine how and when we die, and when we can no longer live with the dignity we would like. We have a right and an obligation to terminate our existence. Now, one of the people who was a sort of disciple of Friedrich Nietzsche was our former fellow resident in Oak Park, Wayne, Ernest Hemingway. And Ernest Hemingway, you know, committed suicide over in Idaho, not too many miles from here, because he could no longer write. He could no longer respect himself. So there was no purpose to live anymore. He very much in his lifetime emulated the middle stage of Nietzsche, the living dangerous stage. His Matador fits very nicely in the middle Nietzschean period. Nietzsche's paradigm model of the man who is living the way he ought is the rope walker. A very familiar sight in European towns at festival time, where the rope walker would come and he would stretch his rope from the roof of the two tallest buildings in the town square, and then at night with floodlight shining up on him, he would walk back and forth on his rope, tempting fate, living dangerously. That's the real life. Well, Hemingway also gloried in this, in the Matador, in the military man, all of him, and the old man out there all by himself fighting that great fish, you know, in Hemingway's last great novel. It's the Nietzschean life of the middle period that you see reflected in Hemingway, and it's the old Nietzsche who is the ethical teacher for the old Hemingway. When about 1898, Nietzsche was living on the second floor of an apartment house in one of the smaller cities of Switzerland. And he lived at the bottom of a rather steep hill. In the middle of the winter, the hill was very slick and very icy. Nietzsche had made a dinner appointment to have dinner with some of his friends from a nearby town, and they were coming to see him because he was writing letters that were kind of incoherent, and they were afraid he was about to have another spell of insanity. Whenever he started moving into insanity, he would write letters, and he wrote a lot of letters to people, but his letters would start getting a bit incoherent, and he would sign them Dionysius, and once in a while he signed them, strangely enough, Jesus Christ. And in his latter days particularly, he saw himself as single-handedly fighting to save the Jews against emerging anti-Semitism in Central Europe. Well, he had written a strange letter, and his friends were coming to see him and have lunch with him, and he came down to the, apparently to the street level, to wait for them. And just then a carter came by with his old emaciated horse, and he had a cartload of wood for the fireplace, and the horse started pulling up the hill, and he stumbled and fell. And the carter whipped the horse, and the horse got back up to his feet, and he started struggling to pull the cart up, and he slipped and he fell again. And the carter grabbed one of the hunks of wood, and he brained the horse over the head and killed the horse. And Nietzsche came rushing out into the street and took the wood away from the carter and started beating him over the head with the wood, and threw himself on the horse. And his friends came up just at that time and pulled him off the horse, and he was crying and holding onto the horse's neck and saying, "Dionysius, my Dionysius." Well, he spent the last 2 years of his life in a mental hospital, and then he died in 1900. And the list of people that were influenced by Nietzsche in one way or another reads almost like a European who's who. Thomas Mann, very strongly influenced by Nietzsche's ideas. He wrote one novel called Dr. Faustus, and the hero was a Nietzschean hero. Hermann Hesse, who just recently has gotten discovered by American college crowd and high school crowd, very much a Nietzsche fan. Stefan Georg, the famous novelist and also biographer, very strongly influenced by Nietzsche. Rainer Maria Rilke was strongly influenced by Nietzsche. Henri Jude, Carl Jaspers. Carl Jaspers said contemporary philosophy has been shaped by two men, Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. Martin Heidegger, who said Nietzsche was the last great metaphysician in the Platonic tradition. Sigmund Freud, "I owe everything I ever knew to Friedrich Nietzsche." And if you look up there at those three over on the left-hand side, you'll see the superego, the ego down at the bottom, and in the middle is the libido. Bernard Shaw, Oswald Spengler, famous author of The Decline of the West, says, "I owe everything to Goethe and Nietzsche." Max Scheler, who is just beginning to be discovered by American philosophers and psychologists, developed the notion of resentment as the basic human emotion. Henri Malraux, who was a French minister of culture until his death a couple of years ago, and Jean-Paul Sartre. Well, that's a lot of people influenced. One of the sad things about Nietzsche is during his entire lifetime, he was trying to find God and he didn't know it. And he moved very logically through all of the stages, except the last one that would have led him up to, you know, "I don't know anything, and it's got to come to me," or "he's got to come to me." But he never quite made it to that point. And so he died in 1900, and for all we know, for all his struggles to try to find meaning and purpose in life, never really found it. Okay.